The College Game Day podcast is presented by Old Dominion Freight Line, helping the world keep promises.
We got a real simple plan. One man, one mission.
Georgia has won the national championship. Touchdown!
If you're a fan, you might think this is sports heaven.
This might be college football heaven. Yeah.
This is ESPN's College Game Day podcast. Now alongside Pete Thamel is Reese Davis.
UT is back. I mean, Texas might be okay too. UCLA might be the best team in Los Angeles, not to mention in the Pac-12. And another edition of Dumb Loses More Than Smart Wins. This is the College Game Day podcast for Monday, October 10th. Reese Davis and Pete Thamel fresh off a delightful trip to the University of Kansas for what turned out to be a scintillating game between the Jayhawks and TCU. TCU, another team that's real after that victory, and Kansas is really good also. But I think, Pete, the place where we start are the lamb chops, the little tiny lamb chops that you and I were devouring at an event for Kansas boosters on Friday night. They were kind enough to invite us to stop by briefly, and we were able to have some good appetizers and then a little trouble extricating ourselves by the end of the evening.
Yeah, it was, Travis Goff invited a few of us everyone from game day over on Friday night. And I thought it would be like a quaint, it was like a wedding in his backyard. I brought a bottle of wine and I was like, yeah, this is going to get lost in the shuffle. I should have just taken it back to the room. There were certainly some of the great characters of Kansas athletics there. I met Mr. Anderson, who the Anderson Football Complex is named after, that we spent some time in over the weekend getting to know the Kansas staff. And Coach Self was there. He made a late appearance, which was it was good to see him. He's got another good team, not surprisingly, there in Lawrence. Doug Girard, the chancellor, the guy in charge in Kansas.
And his the guy wife, in charge who, of the $300 million project that they announced earlier that day.
Yes.
It was part
yes.
of the reason for the celebration.
Yes. No, it looked like you enter Kansas football at that moment, and you could see it's a little bit like Kentucky football, Reese, right? It wasn't like they didn't care. It wasn't like they wouldn't support it. There was just no reason to support it until Mark Stoops came to Kentucky, right? So Kansas, when it had its blip under Mangino there in 07, 08, 09, they showed up. But that was, I will ask you this. You've been to many, many game days over many, many years. I would think it's in the hundreds at this point that you've hosted. What percentile would that Kansas showing and the energy rank there?
Top 2 or 3% in terms of the showing. Kirk at one point mentioned during a break, he said, this is a great crowd. He goes, they're not really sure how to react. And, that was sort of the vibe I got at the event. Now, I want to clarify this. I rarely do anything on Friday nights. This is not norm. I like to go and lock myself in the hotel room and get ready for the show. But I felt like because of the magnitude of having Kansas host game day and they were undefeated, and I thought it was, a good thing for us to swing by and thank them for their hospitality because they were phenomenal all weekend. Everybody that hosts us, they do a great job. Kansas went above and beyond. And we're very grateful for it. So I wanted to go in and visit with Travis and see some of the people. And, they told me Bill would be there, Bill Self. So, it was a good opportunity to do so, but that's not my typical routine on Friday night before game day. And the sense that I got from their boosters was one of apprehension. Not like powerhouses who are worried they're going to lose. Theirs was like, is this real? Because I even had one of their prominent boosters say to me almost in a resigned fashion, well, we're going to enjoy this as long as it lasts. Do you think we can keep Lance? Do you think we can keep Jalen out of the transfer portal? Speaking of Jalen Daniels, I'm like, hey man, you're five and oh. I mean, you're about to become bowl eligible. You've got this thing on the right track, and enjoy it. And there was a sense of apprehension that only comes from generations of losing. But I thought the biggest thing that they did, though they didn't win the game, they acquitted themselves well on that stage against a team that, in my judgment, while Kansas has some talent, I'm not trying to suggest they don't, but in my judgment, TCU is the far superior team athletically, and they gave them everything they wanted right to the very end, even after losing their quarterback to a shoulder injury early. But Jason Bean, by the way, was terrific. He played great when he came in the game.
Yeah, a few things on the game. I really don't think, you know, Kansas didn't win the game, but they won the weekend. I think, like, that was one of the Kansas coaches texted me this Saturday. That was what a top 25 game looks like, right?
Mm-hmm.
It was two teams trading punches, overcoming adversity, finding answers. Look, if Kansas was going to be in that game, I thought they had to shorten the game. The first half of that game took, like, you know, 55 minutes. I'm exaggerating. But it was like, it was at halftime when some of the, like, the normal sort of Big 12 sort of pass fests were, like, early in the second quarter. They took the air out of the ball. They were conscientious about running some clock. They had that one. I mean, that, you know, you can do 100 riddled with regrets in a wild game like that. But they had that fumble on the goal line very early in the game where they could have kind of seized control. TCU took the ball, scored the field goal, marched down early. I thought that was a smart move by Dykes to, like, say, hey, we're going to come in here and run through you. And, you know, speed, as a lot of people pointed out on the show, was obviously the factor. Credit to TCU. They made a very key adjustment. I talked to some of their coaches on Saturday night. They moved Quentin Johnston, my favorite receiver in the country.
You love him.
Podcast
you
listeners would know. Well, yeah. He had 14 catches, 200 and something yards. He had the, you know, spectacular game winner in the back of the end zone. And I just think, like, he is all the talent of the high-end guys in college with the physical intangibles, but they moved him to the inside in certain formations, and he had been exclusively on the outside. And Davis, who's had a remarkable breakout season for them, the little speedster, who's also you know, one of the best return guys in the country, had sort of been in that role a little bit. So I just think they basically said, we are going to, it was as if I was calling the plays, basically.
that was how badly they okay, I want you to finish this. I want you to finish this, but because people like to hear the back and forth, everybody in life loves to be right. Right.
Yes.
So I get a great screenshot text from Pete during the game, which has Quentin Johnston's numbers circled on it. Said, see, but it was really smart. And it's what you and I talked about this on Friday, because I actually checked in with you at one point before a Friday segment. Said, hey, Johnston is good, right? I mean, he's not hurt or anything. You're like, no, good. And just mentioned that Duggan is a little more comfortable in as he goes through his reads and progressions and whatever with the inside receivers. So that makes perfect sense that they would move that weapon in there. And it certainly paid off, 2 bills and 14 catches or whatever it was.
Yeah, that was as dominant of a single performance that a receiver's had this year. And I had said this, and zero humans on earth would remember this, but on game day last week, we did a quick hit on Quentin Johnston. And I said, like, he really only played half the game against Colorado, one quarter against mighty Tarleton. And they had basically held him back knowing they have to play nine straight without a bye. Now, and then some of it just comes down to, like, looks and reads and all that stuff. So that, I think that was there was a sense in the TCU staff, we were going to force him into the game plan this week. And he was clearly, you know, the singular difference maker. Kansas, again, which has come so far since May when Lance took the job. He didn't even have that first spring, May of 21. It's come so far so fast. Jalen Daniels is going to get an MRI this week. We're going to see what's wrong with his right shoulder. It is his throwing shoulder. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, there's no real early feel on it, but my thought would be just with the way he fell and the way it looked, the way they put him right in street clothes, like, it might be hard to imagine him back this week. But credit, Jason Bean played a lot of snaps for Kansas now.
And, it's not his first rodeo out there. He played
that
great.
Big moment didn't look big for him.
Whew, no,
yeah, no, he's a nice player. I, you know, and we'll get to Texas and Oklahoma later, because I believe Kansas goes down to they might have a bye and go to Oklahoma.
No, I think it's this week.
Think they go right there. OK. All right. Yeah. So Kansas, I haven't looked at any lines yet, but Kansas should be favored in that game, right?
Oh, I would think so. I think they have to be.
Which is crazy. This sport is crazy.
Yeah.
If I called you the day before the season started, Reese, and said Kansas is going to be favored at Oklahoma this year, you would have had me committed somewhere.
I'm looking at the line right now, Pete. Oklahoma minus 7. How is that possible?
I mean, lines aren't based on who's going to win. They're based on who's going to bet where. So, I mean, betting is on brands, right? Some guy who doesn't pay that much attention is going to wake up in Seattle and be like, whoa, Kansas, they're only 7-point underdogs. Like, let's roll, you know? So, Reese, Oklahoma at Kansas last year, by the way, a game they almost lost. That was the famous game where Caleb Williams pulled the ball on the fourth down and fell forward and won. One of the great, wacky, individual, quintessentially college football plays we saw all last year.
And probably close to a penalty, right? Close to a forward lateral type penalty.
Yes, there was certainly some. I want to say Kansas was up at halftime in that game. Mm-hmm. Oklahoma was a 38.5-point favorite. So now we look at Oklahoma at home being a 7-point favorite. So that's a 30-point line swing year to year, which, again, Bill Connolly could probably find this in like 6 seconds with his magic fingers, but that's as big of a line, you know, that has to be a top 10 big line swing you'll see all year.
On that subject, Connolly's column that he dropped yesterday, let me hit you with this. Largest underachievement against the spread in a 3-game span for a once ranked team in the last 30 years. There are a lot of caveats in there, but a team that was ranked at one time in a 3-game span over the last 30 years and actual outcome as opposed to what the spread was. Oklahoma is 5th worst this 3-game stretch that the Sooners are on, having underachieved relative to the spread by 98 points. 98.
Caveat Connolly, he brings the goods. I read that this morning. It was remarkable.
But you know, it probably indicates, and the line will likely move next week, probably indicates some worry about Jalen Daniels and optimism that Dylan Gabriel will return for Oklahoma, because they certainly look completely different when he's a quarterback. Weekend Review is brought to you by Eckrich Smoked Sausage. Find them in the refrigerated meat aisle at your favorite grocery store to create one-of-a-kind sausage recipes. Eckrich, you do you. Oklahoma, I'm not sure what Oklahoma was doing against Texas, and I think it's really easy to gravitate toward the negative. So let's do that first before we hit what I feel is my takeaway from the Texas game against a depleted, demoralized, awful-looking Oklahoma team. Look, you can't just go Wildcat if you don't have. You just got to let him play, man. And if you're not going to let him play, I don't understand why you have Davis Bevel on the team or you don't have someone in backup role. You got to go try, because that was a give up move. And I'm sure it wasn't like this. I'm sure that, Jeff Lebby and that staff, they were saying, what could we possibly do to slow the game down and maybe win it? But when you have the 30,000-foot view, as we have the privilege of doing, and you have the job which critiques performance, which is what we do, to me, that said, we got no shot. I don't have any confidence in this backup quarterback. We can't throw it. We're just going to run Wildcat and try to get out of here. And it was akin to, and I don't suggest for a second this was the attitude behind it, but it was akin to when you were playing pickup football in the backyard when you were 6 years old, and maybe there was one guy who was just so much faster than everybody else, and he scored all the touchdowns, and you just were like, "Well, I don't even care. I'm not even going to really try." You know, that's the way it came across to me. It was a bad performance by Oklahoma all the way around, after really building some optimism with their first 3 games, granted not against world beaters, but they played pretty well. And maybe this whole Nebraska curse thing is real, because what are teams like 1-11 after beating Nebraska? I mean, it might be easy to beat Nebraska, but it apparently takes something out of you and steals your soul,
and your offensive coordinator.
It's man, That was that was really a terrible performance by Oklahoma against Texas.
The 2024 NFL Draft heads to Detroit, and it's time to see who gets the job.
Caleb is a unique and special talent throwing the football.
And what sets them apart.
The Heisman Trophy winner is Jaden Daniels.
All of the greats were hired here.
What a throw by Mahomes.
See who gets the job.
Are you ready?
The 2024 NFL Draft begins Thursday, April 25th on ESPN, ABC, and NFL Network.
Where this? I don't know where the Sooners go from here, other than probably getting beat by Kansas at home this week.
So I'm gonna spin this dismal Oklahoma season into a little bit of a riff here, Reese, on the sport we cover and love. So 1 year ago today, coming off Red River, Texas had gotten the doors blown off them in Fayetteville, and they were beaten, soundly, not like blown out, but they were beaten in a pretty wild game in Red River. I think they squandered an early lead.
28-7 lead. They blew, yes, which is yes, what Texas does.
Yes. Yeah. Oh yeah. They are, yeah. They are good in the 49 nothings, the one score games. Yeah. It remains to be seen a little bit. So we're sitting there saying, Texas, how the heck are they going to be ready for the SEC? Right. And that's what I think completely separates college football from the NFL and from any other sport, is just how drastic the swings can be. And just especially in this era we're in right now with NIL and with the portal, it is completely
the rhythms would be like, doo, 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 doo. Like, so Texas, here we are now with Arch Manning coming, with Quinn Ewers looking every bit of what the recruiting rankings said he would be, right? I mean, he can. I'm going to steal your favorite line, Reese. He can spin the magic bean.
Yes, he can.
It is pretty leaving his hand. Mm-hmm. And don't forget, Xavier Worthy in the back of the end zone in Austin against Alabama, when we're sitting there watching from the porch, he lets one go right through his breadbasket. Mm-hmm. They might win that game if Xavier Worthy catches that pass. So
maybe
it certainly would change the complexion and the scoring of, you know, as we saw it. So, but Quinn Ewers, it was just such a tantalizing, it was a really unique build up to his career, right? Because there was all the hype, two snaps at Ohio State, plays fine against Monroe, and then with the world watching, just slices and dices a team in a way that, like, Nick's, I think it was the fourth most yards in a first quarter that Nick Saban had ever given up. So you're like, wow. But it looked good too, you know, the way the ball left his hand, the way it went. So and here we are in Red River. I mean, one of my predictions for this, you know, early predictions for this season is that Ted Roof gets fired and Brent Venables has to sit back and take a long, hard look at a staff that in real time I thought was pretty pedestrian. And the reality is that he's likely either going to have to get way more involved in the defense, or he's going to have to step back and bring in someone to run something a little bit different. Like, he has to make some hard head coaching decisions in a very early time. Ted Roof's history as a coordinator, he's familiar, and that's why Brent brought him in. But Ted Roof's history as a coordinator is one that I would say is pedestrian. Now, I believe he was Auburn's defensive coordinator when they won the title with Cam. But since that time, there have been many stops that have proven to be pretty pedestrian. So I feel like they need to step back, and because now all of a sudden they're the ones that look scary going to the SEC, right? We're sitting here a year ago saying, how the heck is Texas going to build itself up to, you know, to go toe to toe week to week with LSU, with Georgia, without now we're saying, okay, well, Texas played Alabama to a standstill, essentially. And Oklahoma is all of a sudden the one where we're like, whoa, wait a minute. Like, they just from a pure talent level don't appear ready. But I will say this, from talking to coaches who played them this year, they aren't gap sound. They've had massive busts. There is just a lack of general fundamental coaching soundness that Oklahoma defense lacks right now. And that needs to change. And that's on Venables. That's on Roof. That's on everything. Like, that side of the ball has not been aligned right.
Right. Man, I mean, you've seen guys running free in the secondary, which is not, you know, not what you're accustomed to seeing with the Venables defense. And the question, you know, and this is way down in the weeds, but the question I have about that dynamic, and maybe from talking to people in the inner sanctum privately, you have a better answer to this. Is Roof doing what he wants to do, or is he trying to implement the things that Venables wants done and sort of taking care of the areas that Brent doesn't have the time now as a head coach to pay attention to that he did when he was the coordinator, because that historically in college football has been a recipe for disaster. When you aren't going all in either way, you're either trying to coach something you don't know as well because you're trying to please the boss, which we all have to do on some levels anyway, or are you doing something on your own that's not in alignment with the philosophy of the head coach? Either way, whichever way it is, or if it's neither of those things, it is clearly gotten sideways at Oklahoma and fast on defense for sure.
Yeah. This is not like a loaded defense. There's no like jump off the page first round picks, but they also have guys. Like it's still Oklahoma. The sum is not better than the parts there right now. And that's on the staff. Now, I'm not saying like they remember entering the year, the big stat on Oklahoma was they didn't have any first team all Big 12 players on offense or defense. It was just their punter. So they do get a bit of a pass because they don't have some of the high end there's no Nick Benito run around out there like there was last year. They've had the occasional dude on defense. And look, their defense has only been asked to just hold off enough for the offense to score for 3-4 years. So there's some culture change too there. That's important. But
with a healthy Dillon Gabriel, that can be more. I mean, you know this from talking. I'm a big Dillon Gabriel fan. I don't want to underestimate what his absence meant and probably the entire psyche for them as to whether they had a chance. I think he's a really, really good college quarterback, and he's been playing really well too prior to the injury against TCU. So,
yeah, the sad part of this weekend is we probably aren't going to see General Booty in any significant amount, because if he didn't get in that game and they played Nick Evers. Now, if you want some hope for Oklahoma, Nick Evers, the kid from the Dallas area who had been committed to Florida and then flipped after Mullen got fired, went to Oklahoma. There, people loved him in recruiting, loved him. Venables was very optimistic. If you read his quotes this week about where he's come, like he could be the guy in the post Gabriel era, like the centerpiece multi-year starter who can really be the face of the program. So there is some optimism there that they do have a linchpin piece on campus already. He's impressed as much. Our friend Pat McAfee will likely be a little bit sad that General Booty may just, he may just be a lieutenant after all.
McAfee was delighted, but I don't know that I've ever seen the level of joy in any human being to hand out swag than you when the big box of General Booty t-shirts arrived in the office on Friday. Pete was going around the room showing the various designs, and there were a multitude of designs with General Booty on it. I made, everybody has to have a wisecrack on that one. I made the comment that at the risk of being approved, I preferred Private Booty. and in response to that, someone on Twitter had a hilarious suggestion that I'm glad that I didn't see prior to the show, because it would have been entirely too tempting. He said, maybe so. He said, but what if he had someone in his family who achieved the rank of rear admiral?
Touche,
man. What did we ever do before Twitter?
No, that's excellent. That is excellent. I will add, was appreciative of the General Booty t-shirt drop. 20% of all the proceeds go to the Oklahoma Children's Hospital. So the old General Booty seems like he's a generally caring guy. Obviously, son of Abram Booty, former LSU receiver, nephew of John David Booty. He's a JUCO walk-on at Oklahoma, who is one of those characters. Someday a bunch of people, game day staffers, are going to wake up, and then the bottom of their t-shirt drawer, there's going to be an I Love Booty number 14 shirt, and they're going to have a big chuckle from that moment in time. So appreciate General Booty's people for sending those along. It brightened up our Friday morning.
Brilliant NIL work. And what I understand, I guess, is that Abram, who's a good receiver at LSU.
Oh yeah.
He has a great affinity for the military, and that's how General got his given name. This is, in case people don't know, this is not a nickname here. This is, that's his, it's on the birth certificate. It's the given name. Let's go to the positive side of that game quickly. Made the comment off the top of the podcast that UT is back in Texas might be okay too. Obviously, we'll talk about Tennessee in a second. I still want to see Texas win a close game. I know they're explosive. I know they're good. The Texas Tech game lingers. The Alabama game in which they had a chance, and there's been a lot of woulda, shoulda, coulda, and if Quinn didn't get hurt, and you know, sort of suggesting that Alabama was incapable of adjusting, but all of that, clearly they had chances. They didn't win. They didn't win either time. I want to see them win a close game. I think they're going to. I just want to see it. That said, I think David Pollack was on to something when we had the discussion on game day about who the best team in the Big 12 is. Wasn't received well at Kansas. He said it's Texas. And you don't want to overreact by thumping a reeling Oklahoma team, because there's a lot of pent-up frustration in Texas for Oklahoma. They're better than Oklahoma, and that's what good teams do to teams they're supposed to beat. All of those things are good things. But to make that jump is, you know, is a little bit of a leap, but I tend to think Pollack might be onto something there, that Texas might well be the best team in the Big 12. With all due respect to the fellas in Stillwater who are really good, really looking forward to that game when it comes up, might get it twice. And TCU also, a lot of good teams there, but it's not crazy. In fact, it's not even that crazy. I think it might be the most sane of there. The Texas might be the best team in the Big 12.
So let me throw a scenario out, which coming off the Texas Tech game, again, would have sounded insane. But so Texas has Iowa State at Oklahoma State for that big showdown in Stillwater. I know that's sort of on the game day list on October 22nd. They go to K-State after a bye, TCU at home, at Kansas, and then Baylor. So that would give them likely 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 ranked teams. Now, it's the Big 12. It's wacky. It's unpredictable. It's hard. Texas has still, you know, lost 7 of 9 one-score games. So I certainly, as Bill Parcells would say, I don't want to put him in Canton yet. But what if we're sitting here at the end of the year and 2-loss Texas runs the table? And they have a late field goal loss to what we'll assume to be playoff team Alabama. And then they have a close loss on the road at Texas Tech.
In overtime, yes.
Could that be like a 2-loss type schedule that gets you to CFP considers, considering the caliber of wins they would have to have? Now, again, this is college football. Like, it doesn't go this way. It's too, the game is too unpredictable. It's too wacky.
But just like the fact that, like, we could be sitting here saying, you know what, 2-loss Texas in a 2007 chaos theory season as a conference champion could certainly at least like be chattered about. And this is why I don't want to go on this rabbit hole, but this is why when we go to the 12-team playoff, like, Texas can lose 2 games early and absolutely assert itself in the playoff. Like, there's just hope and adrenaline for the bigger picture and the picture that really matters the most, the way the sport has evolved in the long term. But do you think, Reese, a 2-loss Texas team that runs the table, assuming we'll say beats Oklahoma State twice, once on the road, once in a neutral site, could get some chatter for the CFP?
Yes. Under normal circumstances, and by normal circumstances, I mean everybody, not everybody else, but enough other teams stumble, and you don't have the SEC championship game in which it's likely that both teams are going to go.
Yes.
That you also don't have an SEC championship game with Tennessee. Well, I guess it wouldn't work this way, but maybe Georgia. Yeah, this way. You don't have Georgia sitting out there with only a loss to Tennessee, but didn't make the SEC championship game. If you don't have scenarios like that, and you have the stumbles you can come to expect over a college football season, the resume for Texas and the momentum they would have and the close losses would definitely be the 2-loss type of resume that would get considered. That said, I don't think Texas will do that. I think Texas is good. I think they're on the right track. I think they're really good. But I think that Big 12 is deep enough and treacherous enough. So it's two different discussions. Yes, wholeheartedly, if they do it, I think they'll get there. Do I think they are capable of running the table and not slipping up somewhere when just about every game you play in the Big 12 is an opportunity to slip up? I do not think that. So I doubt they get there. But if they do, I agree with you 100%.
Yeah, they would probably be favored in every game other than at Oklahoma State. I would think that would be a, you know, they'd be a field goal, you know, and I'm playing arid region master there. I'm not looking up projected lines. This is the beauty of college football. So say they're favored in 6 of 7 or whatever it is to go. The chances of them winning all those are like, you know, it's probably a 10% chance, right?
Yeah.
But
yeah,
considering coming out of Lubbock, just even that being in the discussion, they're just, what Quinn Ewers does for them is he just opens up a whole different dimension. He opens up the running game for Bijan. We saw it. He makes an electric receiving core that much more electric. So you wonder really what they could be if Jalen Naylor, the kid from Wyoming, didn't get hurt. Because he was, you know, supposed to be a starter, you know, a guy who was obviously hyper productive at that other level, you know, at the Mountain West level. So it's never boring in Austin, Reese. We thank them for that.
That's for sure. The other UT, or the UT, as it were, Tennessee, went to Baton Rouge. I don't think anyone thought that LSU was some juggernaut, especially coming off a game in which they had 85 yards passing against Auburn, but they went in and put the hammer down. I think you got a good indication of how things were going to go in the opening kickoff, you know, bounce right off the chest of a Bayou Bengal in Tennessee. He said, I'll take that. But, you know, they dominated the game. They put 500 yards of offense up again, almost evenly distributed between rushing and passing. They didn't let LSU run the ball at all. And, you know, this is, and they've been rewarded and continually to move up the rankings. Big test coming this week. We'll have plenty of time to look ahead to another opportunity for a cathartic type win from Tennessee against Alabama. But I thought what Tennessee did against LSU, albeit not a vintage LSU team, showed the mettle of a legitimate SEC contender. Now, they have some holes. Their pass defense, while yards per attempt is sort of middle of the road, gross number of yards that they give up is a lot. It's toward the bottom of the country. But their rush defense is good, and certainly they can score, and the tempo can challenge even the best defenses. I thought that was a real positive statement for Tennessee to do that on the road and what could have been a little bit of a peek ahead game, and they were focused on the task at hand.
When I don't care who's coaching. I don't care if it's like the dying embers of the Orgeron era. I don't care if it's an interim. When you go to LSU and hang 40 on them and blow them out wire to wire, that was never a game.
Right.
If you can go there and shoot a kill shot in the first quarter and keep your foot on their throat in that environment, I don't care if it's a noon game, it's a night game, whatever it is, that's impressive. That is a compliment to your program, your scheme, your Heisman candidate at quarterback. So I was unbelievably impressed with not only Tennessee's victory, but just the way. Usually there's some let up, right? Usually the home team is going to come back. LSU is not untalented. So just the fact that they absolutely choked them out in the first quarter and they never woke up is a high compliment to Tennessee and where it is right now in what has been a lightning bolt rebuild by Josh Heupel. There's really no other way to say it. So this is my question, Reese, as we move forward, and we'll break down this game more. We're going to obviously be in Knoxville again. Do you think – we had an electric crowd there for game day for the Florida game. I mean, that was just – they were there when I showed up at 5:30 in the morning. There was 2,000 people there. I mean, it was electric. Do you think – the crowd will be amped even more because Alabama is like, I look at it, I'm a Red Sox fan, right? 2004 to me, when they finally beat the Yankees, was this like seminal moment. Now that was generations of heartache. If you're a Tennessee fan, if you're a Tennessee student, you've essentially never seen Tennessee be competitive with Alabama, right? Like if you're a, you know, it would have happened while you're in diapers. So like when you have a generation of longing, how do you think the fan base reacts on Saturday? And what do you think that environment's like?
it's going to be the Florida environment on steroids. You think you've heard loud? You haven't heard loud until you hear what it's going to be like when they run through the tee on Saturday. What it's going to be Saturday morning and game day, there's not going to be any apprehension there as we saw with Kansas last week. They think they're back. They are starving to be back because it's not just beating the juggernaut. There's a generation of fans who don't understand the vitriol and the disdain and the hatred that Tennessee has for Alabama, and in many cases, vice versa. Now, Alabama's become a little bit numb to that because they're 15-0 under Saban against Tennessee, and the average score has been 39-14. There have been a couple of near misses, but basically it's been routine beatdowns. This reminds me, Pete, and I hate to give this away, but I love our podcast listeners. I'm already planning something for Saturday on game day. 40 years ago, the day after the game, 40 years from Sunday, there was a similar type cathartic breakthrough for Tennessee. The difference was is that Tennessee wasn't great that year under John Majors, but Alabama came in ranked second. They'd lost 11 in a row. They broke out the all-orange uniforms, crazy environment. They intercepted a pass in the end zone. The final seconds of the game, they held on. They won by 7. They tore down the goalpost. They marched them down the strip. They threw them in the river.
Wow.
Those goalposts are headed for the Tennessee River if Tennessee does this again. And part of it is the frustration that Tennessee's had in trying to find their way back to the upper echelon of college football. Part of it is Alabama, because that is that's Alabama's oldest rival. You know, Auburn has some vitriol, but there was, you know, the whole period where the government in the state of Alabama had to get involved to make them play because of some disputes over receipts in the old days. They always played Tennessee. And, you know, that was the big game to the old heads, the olds, as our buddy Pat McAfee calls me, Alabama, Tennessee. That was the game. And I think that because of the heartbreak that Alabama's given them, if you want to take it to another level, go back and think of when Saban was at LSU and he beat them in the SEC championship game and probably knocked them out of a chance to play for the national title. There's a lot of pent-up rage that is going to be right on the surface Saturday, and there will not be another environment in college football this season that will be more electric or more difficult for the visiting team than what Alabama has waiting on them on Saturday. The great John Ward at the end of that 82 game that I mentioned uttered the phrase, he was Tennessee's longtime play-by-play announcer, uttered the phrase, pandemonium reigns. And pandemonium is right bubbling on the surface and ready to be unleashed on Saturday. It's going to be intense. It is going to be very intense on Saturday, I think.
One of my favorite things in sports, and it's one of the great things about covering college basketball especially, is when something happens either for the first time, like the school goes to the dance for the first time or wins a game in the dance for the first time, or in college football, when something happens for the first time in a long time. There's really, to me, nothing in pro sports that just captures that emotion, because the school is such a fabric of the identity of the entire state. And like Alabama has just become so superior that it literally like affects the psyche of millions of people, you know, right from Memphis all the way over to the Appalachian Mountains. So you have all of that for 20 years just boiling up, and you just watched, you know, you're looking at your neighbor down the road, right? The one you used to sneer down on, become this dominant force. And now here's this one moment to go snatch that back. And to me, that is a really unique moment in time.
100%. And there are so many subplots that have sort of been forgotten through the years, but Philip Fulmer being subpoenaed by people in Alabama because he was sending stuff to the SEC about Mike DeBose's recruiting practices, that caused a lot of animosity between the two sides. You know, and in many ways, Alabama people who have a disdain for Fulmer, they ought to be happy because, you know, he sort of helped orchestrate that tumultuous Franchoni, Mike Price, Mike Shula era that ultimately brought them Nick Saban. I mean, Fulmer instead, I've contended for years, he really should have been doing everything in his power
to keep Mike DeBose as the head coach at Alabama for as long as he could. You don't want to turn him in for, you know, for recruiting stuff. You ought to be helping him a little bit, you know, because that was when things started to shift. But that's old history stuff. But it's interesting, and I think it for a certain generation of the fans at Tennessee, that's where the intensity is going to come from. I don't think that there's going to be the apprehension, even that you sensed from Florida in the Florida game late, where they're like, oh, no, this isn't really going to happen. We're not going to blow this. I think there is such disdain for Alabama that there won't be any of that feeling in the stands. And certainly Heupel and his staff and the players, they don't know anything about any of that. They just think they're playing great football and they're going to go, you know, they're confident they can beat anybody. This is all, I'm talking atmosphere stuff. I'm not talking on the field, because the guys on the field and the coaches, they don't care about any of this stuff. You know, that stuff doesn't matter. It only matters in creating the environment. So that's going to be a great scene in Knoxville on Saturday. A lot of times I don't like repeat visits, and I'd more behind the scenes stuff. I'd advocated actually a couple weeks prior to the Tennessee Florida trip of looking elsewhere that week and saving our Tennessee trip for this week for Alabama, you know, just in case the game turned out to be the matchup that it is. As it turns out, going there twice in a short period of time is going to be great just because of the way things unfolded. It was, you know, we felt like we might be at Utah this week, but after Utah lost to UCLA, and it's not always predicated, these decisions, on who wins a game or loses a single game. You forget that by Saturday a lot of times. But in this case, it did take a little bit of the luster off of USC's visit to Salt Lake City. Mm. UCLA, on the other hand, man, oh, man. I mean, what a dominant second half performance offensively. Now, Utah kept staying with them until, you know, I think they had a turnover, maybe had a fumble on one of the drives, and they were down a couple scores, and they didn't answer. But that was a highly entertaining game. And also, I thought, made a real statement about the Bruins, and we've talked about their preseason schedule, pre-conference season schedule, and maybe South Alabama's better than, well, not maybe, they are better than most people realize. It's still South Alabama, and they survived that game. UCLA is rounding into form, and as good as and talented as USC is, UCLA looks to be anybody's equal in the Pac-12 right now and in Los Angeles. That was a really impressive performance against a really good Utah team.
Yeah, South Alabama may be the Heisman winner for dumb loses more than smart wins with that fake field goal that they called in that game. I don't know if you remember that.
I do remember.
That was preposterous. Chip, I said going into the game last week, you know, Chip has built a team much in the mold that Utah's built. And clearly their mousetrap's a little better this year. My big takeaway from watching UCLA on Saturday was I was just thrilled for Dorian Thompson Robinson. All right. Mm-hmm. He's 18 of 23, 299, 4 touchdowns, 1 interception. But to me, I mean, this is a kid who committed to Jim Mora, right? This is a kid. Mm-hmm. He was a really highly regarded recruit out of Bishop Gorman in Las Vegas. And he came to UCLA and he went through the full collegiate arc, which you rarely see. It was heralded coming in. He struggled, you know, and then there has been real development, though, that happens. And quarterback development, Reese, can't be microwaved. You cannot develop a quarterback just by inserting him in a system and going. And Dorian Thompson Robinson, who's a marvelous athlete, took a little bit of time. And what you're seeing now is that collective time. Chip Kelly, for my money, is still one of the best quarterback tutors and offensive minds in all of college football. It looks a lot different than it did when he was doing it with the Ducks. But in terms of game planning, in terms of taking what he has and manipulating the opposing defense with it, there's just a lot of genius there, quite frankly. And so I know Chip hates that word. So when I just saw UCLA marching up and down the field, and then you got Zach Charbonneau going for, you know, nearly 200 on 22 carries, by the way. So one of the new molds that you can do now in college football is you can get old, right? Mm-hmm. You can get old fast. And UCLA has gotten old. They've gotten old through guys who stuck around, and they've gotten old through transfers who've come in. And by doing that with
a crew of tight ends who are amongst the best in the sport outside of Georgia, who clearly has the best crew of tight ends. They have developed a smash mouth, hard nosed identity, and all the credit in the world for Chip and UCLA having the patience to get to this moment, because it has been an incremental, gradual build. And DTR has had a lot of criticism. He mentioned that in some interviews this week. And there's been a process of development to get to this point. But he didn't duck. He didn't transfer back to UNLV and try to do it again. He didn't look for an easy way. He sat there and faced it. And they're paying the dividends now. And I would think that there's a chance we could be seeing the Bruins in Eugene.
I agree. That'll be a great environment, too, with Chip going back, both teams being really good. I think they've got 20 guys in grad school, which, to your point of them getting old, and for all of the attention, and rightfully so, that USC got about working the transfer portal, Chip sort of worked it in a lower key fashion. They've got a lot of guys on that team, particularly on defense, that mm-hmm. started their careers elsewhere. And so they've put together a veteran scrappy group. And it's one of the things we've talked about on the podcast that people say, well, okay, so you're old, big deal. You're not as subject to the emotional swings that a younger team is if you've been around and seen a lot. You know, I mean, you don't get overwhelmed by environments or situations, or if a game starts going sideways a little bit. Older guys who maybe on their second or sometimes even third stops, they can handle those things better, because you're dealing with, 22, 23 year old men. Now, they may not be fully mature pros, but they're not kids. For the most part, a lot of these players aren't kids. They're grown men. And when you have someone who has a few more years of experience, not just on the field, but in life, those men tend to handle those circumstances a little bit better. And that's pretty conducive to Chip's coaching style, too, I think, is to have older, mature guys on his team. And it's paying dividends. And that'll be a great scene. I think both teams are off this week, too. So nothing in the wacky world of college football can really screw up that meeting with the Ducks. Next week, I already had someone reaching out saying that should we go there, that LaMichael James should be the guest picker, and he's eager to do it, which, with the relationship and the success he had with Chip, and then obviously the connection to Oregon, there might be, I'm always good for a good Ty Burrell guest picker sighting too, but being the big duck that he is, but LaMichael would be a good choice as well. So we can look at that. But I think they're really good, Pete. And one thing we ought to bring up, in regards to the Pac-12, they're not doing the division thing in terms of the championship game this year. So Utah's not out yet. They can still take care of their business, beat USC, get another shot, at UCLA, assuming that UCLA continues on the path that it's on right now and makes it.
Yeah, good for the Pac-12 for reasserting themselves in the conversation nationally this season. That had been sporadic probably in the past 4 or 5 years. But you and I can't root for teams and programs, but like I like a healthy, vibrant sport from coast to coast. I think in our chair, we can both agree to that, right?
Agree.
Yeah. And so I can't sit here and tell you that, how healthy or vibrant the Pac-12 is going to be as a league until there's another set of TV contracts that come through, and that expired grant of rights certainly has people on the West Coast nervous. But I'm just happy that people can say, okay, we just don't have to eliminate the West Coast from college football conversation. One of the delights of this sport is that, you can be in Pittsburgh 1 week and Eugene the next, or Coral Gables 1 week and Pullman the next. And so I just don't think it benefits anybody if that West Coast goes dark in any way. So I'm just happy that they're in the conversation. I'd be giddy to, to get on a plane and get to Eugene the following week. And to accentuate your point about the quarterbacks, DTR turns 23 in November. Mm-hmm. Hendon Hooker is 24. And like those dudes have seen some stuff. Like, I don't care who you are. I don't know anybody who at 19 was the same as they were at 23 or 24. Those are years you develop physically, maturity, everything, in a significant way. So good for those guys for sticking around in DTR's place, or in Hendon finding a place where he can go thrive. And those are the stories that it's a little old school, and I don't want to be the guy yelling at the cloud. I have no problem with the portal. I have no problem with NIL. But it is just nice to see guys find a place in a
in a situation that accentuates their skill set, and they struggle through adversity and find success.
No question. I mean, it's a good thing for everybody. I'm totally on board with all of those things. I ran across this last week, and I want to get back to the Pac-12 and their somewhat throw up in their own mouth scenario here, potentially. I ran across this in the notes last week about old quarterbacks. Max Duggan, who has, you know, potentially worked himself into the Heisman race, not to mention made TCU a legit contender and was terrific again against Kansas, is a senior. The guy who originally won the job at TCU and was injured and is now a backup is Chandler Morris. And by classification, he is listed as a redshirt freshman. Ran across this in the notes. Chronologically, by birthday, Chandler Morris is older than Max Duggan. How about that when it comes to getting old?
I think old Chandler,
a redshirt freshman who's older than a senior.
He got a little Texas redshirt from dad. Chad Morris has been around a little bit. He's, you know, he's not letting old Chandler run in at the same at the same class. So that's my hunch. And Chandler has probably moved around a bunch too, right? He lived in he was in, I want to say, Tulsa, Clemson, and then obviously went back to SMU, Arkansas. So
because I occasionally give parenting advice, and I would give this to you and young Teddy.
Please do. I need it.
If Teddy is an aspiring athlete, do that. I know people say no, but my son was 17 when he graduated high school, and that made a difference. That made a difference in where he was in the recruiting calendar and stuff like that. Now you don't do it at the expense of everything else. The other thing it does is because my daughter was also, and she's not an athlete, she's an actress. She also graduated high school at 17. Huh. And we have looked back at that and we're like, what in the world? What was our rush? Start them later, man. And they leave too soon. So keep young Teddy around the house a little bit. Start him in school late. Yeah. I don't care how smart he is. He'll still be smart. That was our thing. We're like, well, they appear to be ready for school. Let's start him. No, keep him home, man. That's what you should do.
So I don't think Kate's ready to let Teddy go when he's 27. So,
hey, look, when they're 25 and 22, as mine are now, you're still not ready, pal. So go ahead and enjoy that. But you have to. That's life. That's what you do. But still not ready. I mentioned the Pac-12 sort of nightmare scenario. Can you imagine, Pete? It is great. We want the vibrant sport coast to coast, but with UCLA and USC on their way to the Big Ten, don't you think that those remaining behind would sort of be regurgitating in their own mouth if USC and UCLA were, say, playing in the championship game, a rematch? Maybe they're undefeated the first time they play and get all the attention. Then they rematch in the Pac-12 title game, which you can do now without the divisions, and they're playing for a spot in the CFP. Oh, boy.
Well, think about this, too. I believe they play November 19th weekend, right? And I believe they play at the Rose Bowl. I want to be clear that I have about as much say as where game day goes as, you know, what ads go on Monday Night Football. So I want to be clear that in my basement cubicle, nobody's asking my opinion. But I did look at the schedule like, you know, anyone could, and looked at potential games, and that we could, there's a chance, Reese, we could be at the Rose Bowl for undefeated or close to it, USC and UCLA, for a fun little feisty LA game on November 19th. And that would be like all the Pac-12 spotlight on the leaving schools. And then they could play each other again, as you said. So like, that's a lot of oxygen and a tough reminder, literally, as they're like trying to finalize a TV deal for the next iteration too. So squeamish is a word that comes to mind. Yes, you can taste the bile in your own mouth on the other 10 campuses there, if that is the scenario that plays out.
Well, you know what? Maybe Bo Nix and the Ducks might have a little something to say about that.
Oh, yeah.
Well, you know what? We say that, and understandably so. I mean, having, you know, been around them a little bit and knowing the people who've worked with him as quarterback coach, the talent has always been there.
Always.
For Bo, it's been channeling that in a consistently positive manner. Yeah, he's doing that. Last five games, 20 touchdowns, one turnover. And they've won them all. I mean, the change of scenery has been really good for him. And I think some of that, this is pure speculation on my part, so entrenched in Auburn and so desperately wanted to help them be elite that maybe the emotions got the best of them at times. And, you know, look, the Georgia thing was a debacle. Georgia was geared up and ready, Lanning's first game, but he's turned it around. And I, you know, I'm really, really looking forward to seeing them go against UCLA. It ought to be, ought to be really fun. Don't know if game day will be there, not suggesting that, but just watching
it's
the game.
Possible. It's possible.
It's very, it's very possible. I'll put it that way.
Claire, I look at the schedule on Sunday sometimes when I'm sitting with my wife watching the NFL, with little Teddy and say, oh, we could go there. We could go. I literally look at top 25 games. And when there's two numbers by the teams, I mention that as a possibility. Yeah.
I'm going to give you a say here. You say you don't have anything game day, which the self-deprecation is overwhelming there by you, by the way. I'm going to give you a say here. If you are choosing for our weekly dumb loses more than smart wins moment of the week.
Dumb ways to die.
And look, there are a lot of, there was the horrendous fake field goal by Bowling Green, but they were already in trouble. So that didn't really,
I want to say that got called back by penalty.
Yeah. But I mean, it was, you know, it was just bad. Just the whole idea, but they were already in trouble anyways. It's not really that. So it's a couple of, one marquee game and one that that you confessed earlier you fell asleep on, which surprised me because usually you and I are texting throughout. Somehow I was wide awake for it. The Oregon State virtual walk-off against Stanford, which kept my, I won't say my favorite stat, but the one I keep repeating is they haven't won a game against an FBS team over a calendar year, and it looked as if they had them on the ropes. And then Trayshawn Harrison caught a pass over Ethan Bonner, and Patrick Fields, the Oklahoma transfer, sort of, I mean, I understand he was reacting to the ball, but man, my buddy Rod Gilmore, the former Stanford defensive back, deepest to deepest, widest to widest all the time, you know, and they let him out and he scored. And so that's one candidate. Would it be that, or would it be the one shot to win the game play call by Texas A&M on the goal line against Alabama after the pass interference penalty in the end zone gave them another shot that negated an interception?
They're both sort of negligent in their own ways, right? Like they're both strong candidates. The A&M one obviously got a lot more oxygen because of the moment's sake. How about Johnny Football ripping it on Twitter? Did you see that?
Yeah.
I loved it.
Yeah.
Johnny Football questioning decision-making, right? That's beautiful.
Some irony there for sure.
After about a decade of his own pretty good trail of it. That guy was a first round pick. That always blows my mind. So the A&M play to me, if you are in that, you know, essentially 2-point like conversion. Like I saw Nick break it down on his TV show. Michael Casagrande wrote a great article about that play in that moment and got into some of the leverages. It was really well done on AL.com. But you got to throw the ball in the end zone, right? Like that's just the one thing. You have to give yourself a chance to win the game. Like there's many, many other, even if you run and you give yourself a chance to win the game, like you cannot throw the ball in a position where you can lose the game. Now, he threw it poorly enough where the guy in poor position couldn't even catch it. But to me, I don't know if that's on the play call or it's on the route or on the quarterback decision making. It's probably on a combination of all of them in some sense. I will say this, we've been modestly critical of Haynes King on this podcast, right? He's had some moments of mediocrity, I think would be the polite way to say it. And I've been vocal, both kind of just chatting with you and on the pod about, you know, wanting to see a little bit of Connor Wigman, right? He's a 5-star. And I thought the way the offense was trending in the first half, again, they scored a little bit because Jalen Milroe was handing the ball over. I thought we may see him for a flash, you know, a little desperate flash in the third if the score had increased and A&M was desperate for a spark. So good for Haynes King for really, you know, putting in a gutsy. He got crushed, right?
He got drilled. drilled all night.
And drilled again and drilled again. So that was one of the gutsier performances, just in terms of pulling yourself up off the turf and keep going, you know, that I've seen in college football this year. So ton of credit for him for that. And you hate that his night gets distilled to that one moment, but that's, you know, that's sort of where we are. And that's what he signed up for. The Stanford play was just really, really poor. I mean, really sloppy. And is that the design of the defense more than just a bad decision / angle by the safety? I don't know. But like, you can't let that happen.
Can't let it happen. Yeah.
Can't let it happen.
Can't. So. I mean, because they needed a touchdown. It's not like you needed to keep them out of field goal range. You had to stop the touchdown. And I hate to pile on, but you've convinced me because of the gallant effort, which Stanford also had a gallant effort.
Sure.
I stayed up and watched that game and was shocked. I think as shocked as Mark Jones and RG3 were when the touchdown happened, but I was shocked because you felt like Stanford, you know, had kind of earned the game and the old beef pulled it out of the fire. I guess they lose this week again and they get the dumb loses more than smart wins. The play, not the players. I feel almost bad about this one because I feel like that was from a place of aggression. You know, it was kind of a miracle catch over Ethan Bynner. He's a good corner.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they didn't have Blue Kelly, but Bynner's been starting anyway. So it's not like there was an inexperienced guy there. And Fields is experienced and he just, you know, too sharp underneath. Yeah. And then the guy ran away from him. So
Fields one of the most aggressive kids that I've been around the last couple of years. He's been on a lot of those NCAA committees for rules change. Like he went to Stanford from Oklahoma, you know, to get a graduate degree and go play. Like he's an unbelievable kid, but that's, look, when you're a defensive back, you sign up for the potential where you know, he might've played unbelievable. He might've had the highest PFF grade of anybody, in all the plays preceding it there, but that was, you got to tackle.
Got to get him down. Even in that situation, you know, pass interference is better than, better than what ended up happening. So it's with some regret. I usually like to find the completely goofy ones. And there were certainly some plays that merited that this week, but to actually lose the game, you know, seemed to be the one there. So our condolences and we're not supposed to root, but I'd like to see Stanford get a win. I mean, they've had some tough breaks for sure.
Yeah.
A lot to look forward to. Because we try to look back instead of forward, can't wait to look forward on Wednesday to Michigan and Penn State. Certainly much more on Alabama and Tennessee, you know, there, and then maybe some rising programs as well. So that's going to do it for this edition of the College Game Day podcast. Join us 3 times a week. Download anywhere you prefer to get your podcast, or Pete Thamel, who little did you know is breaking news right in the middle of this podcast, but couldn't report it just yet. That's a tease. Maybe by Wednesday. We'll see you next time.